Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, with Billy Joel fading out in the background. Back from 2 weeks off, got to stretch my legs and enjoy the occasional sun coming over Western Europe once in a while. Coming to you live from Amsterdam today, city of the cyclists. I've already eaten questionable fried food and been called an idiot by a cyclist for crossing the cycling path too boldly, so I'm almost ready to move in. My guest this week is Benjamin Franke. He's an accredited parliamentary assistant for the member of the European Parliament, Ulrike Müller, from Germany. Benjamin is an expert on all things agriculture, so we are talking about the EU's farm-to-fork strategy and what it means for consumers. Also in this episode, my colleague Maria Chaplia is joining me to present the Pandemic Preparedness Index. Michael Landl from the World Vapers Alliance comes on to talk about how World Vape Day went, and we are talking about the EU's emissions trading system. So let's get started with that last topic right away. So the question, of course, what is this emissions trading system? The emissions trading system is a system by the European Union in which certain sectors need to pay in order to offset their carbon dioxide emissions. So this is, for instance, very known for the aviation sector. Every time you book a flight ticket, you will be paying a bit extra, and that extra is to offset your CO2 emissions. Of course, this is supposed to incentivize certain sectors to reduce their CO2 emissions in order to reach the overall target of the European Union when it comes to the environment. Now, what the European Commission is now trying to do, this is Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, she tries to extend this ETS system to transport and construction, or the building sector overall. The irony, of course, with that is when we talk about transport specifically, is we as Europeans are targeting the road sector, so the entire lorry sector transporting things around the continent. You see all of them whenever you use a motorway. And in the United States, they do it very differently. You know, Americans, they put the goods on rail and they put people in cars. We do the exact opposite. We put people in high-speed trains and we put goods on lorries. But that's the system as it is. The question, of course, who will be paying that extra? Because if you charge a company to bring a good throughout the continent, if you charge them, of course, they will be putting that on consumers. That means that the prices in the supermarkets or on any other product, electronics products, whatever needs to get transported, will then rise for consumers. Of course, this is one of the indirect taxations that you don't see on the bill that you will be actually paying. At least with VAT, you see how much it is. Of course, with all of these other indirect taxes that are charged to companies, it is not as apparent. Now, the other question is, how do poorer member states cope with changes done on the ETS level? Because, for instance, let's say we include heating for houses in the ETS trading system. If you go to much of Eastern Europe, the heating is done, you know, according to the local availability of gas. Usually it's heating with gas. And of course, if you put an extra environmental tax on that for people who already struggle to pay their heating bills, how fair is that? And then some of the advocates of the system will say, well, the richer countries will pay the difference. So a country like France ought to pay more anyway, because it has a certain consumption and people have more money, so they'll be paying the difference. Problem is, of course, that a country like France doesn't actually have too many CO2 emissions arising out of heating, because most of the heating is done electrically through nuclear energy. And if you already have a quasi-net zero emissions production of heating, then that country will not actually be contributing to a redistributive system that allows you to then help those poorer member states. So the redistribution system will be complicated to do. And also the assumption, by the way, that people are not struggling financially in those quote-unquote richer countries is also not true. You have a lot of people in France and Germany who struggle to pay their heating bills. And how far is a non-progressive tax on them? When we talk about VAT being an unjust tax because it is indiscriminate of your specific income, well, then this would also count as an additional tax on consumers. The other thing is that for the building sector to become more sustainable, they also want to have certain energy classes to be compulsory in certain countries. So for instance, in Luxembourg, if you build a new house, you have to build it according to the highest classes of the environmental standards, which also increases your building costs significantly. And with all the entire talk about young people not being able to buy and buy houses or build houses for that matter, it's also just going to make it considerably more expensive if those sort of rules are implemented. So there again, I think that the ETS system is just another way of framing a tax. You will not be hearing from anyone that there will be additional carbon taxes in any way. They will say, well, this is an emissions trading system and it's specifically put on the construction company. Yes, but ultimately, you, the consumer, are the one who ends up paying for it. So ironically, the French seem to be getting it right, especially when it comes to the heating sector, because having built a system on nuclear energy, it allowed them to reduce their carbon emissions significantly. Not only that, but also provide cheap electricity for their citizens. So this is actually something that we should be looking at. Fortunately, actually, the European Commission does not give guidance on how exactly the energy is supposed to be produced. So nuclear energy is not discriminated against in those sustainability targets. But you see that even France and Belgium are trying to phase out their nuclear energy in the long run. So again, there, we don't exactly know how this is all supposed to be achieved, but we just know that consumers are supposed to pay for it. And I think, you know, you would think that with all the experience that we had in the past years, with the entire discussion on the yellow vests that was in France, with the conclusion of the government being, yes, well, it is true that ultimately it is socially unjust. Well, then who is supposed to pay this tax? Who is supposed to pay the extra cost? And I think there the crux is that in France, it was a specific petrol tax that you could quantify and you could go to the petrol station and make the calculation for yourself and say, well, it's going to cost me half a cent more per liter of petrol. But with this specific tax, it's really hard to figure out how much it actually amounts to, because it really depends on the member state, it depends on your overall energy situation. And I think this is where it gets complicated. And when you do things like that, and people don't have an actual footstand to argue against a specific tax, it just amounts. It amounts and it culminates up until the point that people are angry at something. They don't know exactly what they're angry at, but the cost of living has increased so much that they're happy to blame anyone. And I think this is where it gets very problematic. And then ultimately, European politicians will say, well, you know, there's just populism and they're angry at someone, at the foreigners or whatever. But ultimately, the cost of living was imposed on them by these indirect charges all around. And this is just another one. You know, whether it's the conversation about a carbon border adjustment, which is also just a tax, or the ETS system, all of these are charges to be paid by consumers. And I think we should really think about this in a very different way before we ask consumers to pay another cent into a budget of anyone. Because ultimately the question, you know, that politicians also need to answer is, does this actually achieve the goals? Like, will the construction sector actually be more sustainable environmentally because of these taxes? And the evidence for this is not very convincing. It is not convincing that an ETS integration of heating, construction, and transport will result in these environmental benefits. You know, it's the age-old question about these reduction targets. You know, if you take a reduction targets in mobility and you say, well, all of these vehicles need to have a CO2 reduction by, let's say, 50%, in the next 10 years. Well, if they naturally do a reduction in that time frame, then the law is not necessary. But if they don't achieve it, then what are you supposed to do as a government? Well, then you can only financially punish someone, well, the producer or whoever, because they're breaking the law. We already have a significant CO2 reduction in many of these transport sectors over time. These are natural occurrences because ultimately the company that is doing the logistics, that's doing the transport, is not in cahoots with the petroleum industry. They don't want to pay more for their use. The aviation sector is the same thing. No airline is going to try to pay any more kerosene than they have to. They try to reduce their consumption as well, because this is what reduces your running costs. So ultimately, this is about putting the finger on innovation as opposed to centrally organizing the way that we reduce CO2 emissions. But now let's bring on my colleague here at the Consumer Choice Center, Maria Chaplia. She's the research manager at the Consumer Choice Center and recently co-authored the Pandemic Preparedness Index 2021.
So to start with, obviously, it's been more than a year into the pandemic. The world is starting to get back to normal, especially with the vaccine rollouts being successful in, well, more or less, it's starting in every country now. And since most of us spend so much time in lockdowns, quarantines, it's been a bit of a reflection time of what went wrong, who didn't perform very well. And so we wanted, me and Tret, who are the authors of the index, we wanted to look at how health system globally were prepared for the pandemic, because I think it's not a new fact that we've known for a while that something like coronavirus would happen. There are many people mentioned this, many scientists warned about this, but I don't think we were taking this seriously enough. And so the health resilience is only one part of this pandemic preparedness, because of course we know that saying that even if country was very well prepared for the pandemic in terms of critical care beds, in terms of its regulations being flexible enough to be able to change themselves and sort of speed up vaccine rollout, speed up testing, it's only one part of mortality rate of the number of cases in particular country, but still it's one of the most important factors, because if you have many people who need ventilators and critical beds and you don't have sufficient numbers of those, then obviously you'll have India-like scenario or Ukraine-like scenario, which are some of the worst countries on the index list. And so that was kind of the motivation behind the index. And we looked at the major factors relating to health resilience, trying to sort of see what countries did right, what they did wrong, and to sort of be able to prepare for future pandemics.
And so which countries performed particularly well and which countries performed particularly badly? Because, you know, I think our listeners will have some sort of an idea of which countries make the cut there, but just remind us.
Yeah, sure. I think it's a bit of a predictable outcome, the ones we have in the index. So Israel and UAE performed the best. So we ranked countries in terms of their resilience. So we had highest resilience, above average resilience, below average resilience, and lowest resilience. And the highest resilience we have Israel and UAE. Most EU countries had average resilience, except Luxembourg, Germany, Austria, I think, Malta and Cyprus, I think, too, because they were testing really well. New Zealand and Ukraine were some of the worst countries. Brazil, India had below average level of resilience.
So do you think this index provides some insight for countries as to what they can improve you don't want to say years leading up to the next pandemic. We don't want to sound too grim, but ultimately that's what it means. You know, what does this provide also a toolbox for countries to get inspired as to what they can improve in their health systems?
I think to some extent it does, particularly when it comes to regulations and vaccine approval, because in the index we calculated the lag by days compared to the UK, meaning how many more days it took particular country to kick off the vaccine campaign compared to the UK. And you can see the countries that were least prepared for the pandemic, like Ukraine, New Zealand, they took like 80 days more. And every day matters when it comes to pandemics. So this is a very costly mistake they have in their regulations. I think it took the EU like on average 24 days more, and the Netherlands was one of the worst countries in the EU because it started vaccinating something like more than 35 days after the UK. So I think from this perspective, regulations have to be a bit more reconsidered from this perspective, I think. Same applies to testing. The EU hasn't done very well on testing. When it comes to the US, there also has been red tape because they weren't able to start testing really fast because of FDA's regulations preventing that. Yes, and I think it applies to many countries across the board. And then again, we can look at countries such as Cyprus, who's tested many people. So, and from this perspective, they are kinds of examples of what can be done better.
One concluding question. Did you see any correlation between performing well or badly in this index and the size of the country? Because we had this entire conversation about, oh yeah, it's easy for a small country to do a lot of tests because you don't have that many people. Was there in any way that you could see that big countries were doing better or small countries were doing better? Or was there absolutely no relationship between the size of the country and the performance in the index?
That's an interesting question. I am not sure there's correlation. Because you have big countries like Ukraine that tested not very many people, and then you have smaller countries in the EU. I think Spain or even Netherlands, they are much smaller and they didn't test as much as smaller countries such as I think Malta tested. And then you have US, which is big, UAE, which is also relatively big. So I don't think there's any correlation with size. It more has to do with how fast they started testing. I think UAE is a very interesting country, especially for European countries to look up to, because they started testing really early. They had drive-throughs and testing was encouraged. It was provided. People were encouraged to get tested every 10 days. So it was very extensive, unlike a bit of EU and US mess.
Well, very interesting insight into the pandemic and the reactions of countries. In any way, you can find that entire index under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. So thank you so much, Maria, for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Next up, Michael Lundell, director at the World Vapers Alliance. He recently wrapped up World Vape Day 2021. And let's see how it went this year. So, Michael, you just a few days ago wrapped up World Vape Day. How'd it go? What's the ultimate? Explain to the listeners who hear about World Vape Day for the first time. What's the point of World Vape Day?
Yeah, happy belated World Vape Day. It's basically a day of celebration for vaping and the great innovation brought to the tobacco harm reduction field. And it is not a coincidence that it is a day before World No Tobacco Day from the WHO. Where we always hear those kind of messages that vaping is actually a bad thing and doesn't work as a smoking cessation method. And we thought last year we need to get another messaging out there a day before and said, okay, let's do our own World Vape Day, where we have the opportunity to celebrate actually the positives of vaping and all the great changes it brought to our lives.
The contrast is huge. You know, the day we're recording this segment is on actually a World No Tobacco Day of the World Health Organization, and their messaging is very different. I saw this post on social media today where they say, well, you know, throw all your smoking devices to the bin, and that included cigarettes, but also vaping devices. What would you say, like, as an elevator pitch, what does the World Health Organization get wrong, and what is the message they should understand about e-cigarettes and all other vaping devices?
To be honest, it seems like they get everything wrong about vaping, because they equate vaping with cigarettes, and that's why they also want to treat it the same way, but clearly it is not the same thing. It is already proven many times that it is less harmful. The Public Health of England already said it's 95% less harmful, so it's clearly a different thing than smoking. And therefore should be treated differently. But the WHO is completely failing on this. Since you mentioned that tweet, another tweet today was that they gave out a medal to the health minister of India, who banned e-cigarettes completely in a country where you have still millions of smokers and denying them and proven effective and less harmful alternative to consuming nicotine and quit smoking. So I think that already shows how important a thing like World Vape Day is.
Yeah, and we've seen during World Vape Day, when you check the tweets, is that a lot of vapers are getting active. More and more people are becoming aware of this. What is your pitch to vapers? You know, it's like just an everyday person. I'm using e-cigarettes on a regular basis, but I don't entirely understand how my voice matters, how my activism could be important. What are like the start of tools that the World Vapers Alliance offers to people?
Every voice matters, and wherever we can, we try to help our members, but the general vaping community, to amplify their voices and help them to raise their voices, because especially in the EU, we see also very harsh regulations for vaping on the horizon by the European Beating Cancer Plan. They already suggested flavor bans and increased taxation. things like that. And this will be the direction for TPD as well. So it's very important that we as citizens, but also as consumers, push back on those kind of proposals. And therefore, it's important to be as loud as possible. We as World Vapers Alliance have our Back Vaping Beat Cancer campaign, where we ask consumers to sign a petition that vaping should be included in the beating cancer plan as harm reduction method, and have also a portal where vapers can directly contact the MEPs and tell their own personal story, because I think that is the most effective and most influential way of changing minds of politicians, to tell them our stories. We have thousands of them. We are almost all, everybody is a former smoker, and vaping changed the life to the positive. And I think most politicians just don't know those kind of things. And the more vapers who reach out to politicians, the better it is, and the harder it is to ignore our voices.
As a concluding point, and you mentioned the flavor bans, you know, I'm currently in the Netherlands, and there is this entire discussion about a flavor ban. And for those closed systems, it already exists for petrol stations and little newsstands, that the only flavors allowed to be sold are conventional tobacco taste and menthol. Now, I think we briefly talked about this in the past, the effects of these flavor bans, because, you know, the average consumer that is not an e-cigarette user sees like bubble gum and cinnamon and so on. And the question could, of course, be asked, why are these odd, weird, fanciful flavors? How are those important for the goal of harm reduction?
I mean, my question for you would be then, why do we need strawberry ice cream? We all like flavors in some form. So why would it be different in e-cigarettes and in vaping? And generally, the numbers show that about 2/3 of adults are using some kind of flavor or other flavors than tobacco. So it's a key element of the effectiveness and the success of vaping, especially the flavors. If you're a former smoker, you don't want to be reminded of the flavor of the taste of cigarettes anymore. And that is why you use flavors. And if they get banned, I think it should be clear for everyone that the demand doesn't go away. So then vapers only have two options. Either they go to the black market, where there are no quality controls, no age controls, things like that, so very detrimental, or they are forced to return to smoking, which would be also a very bad unintended consequence. And I mean, in the case of the Netherlands, it's actually outrageous if you think about the public consultation, which was held, where 98% of all submissions were against the flavor ban, and now this caretaker government still pushes through. That's just outrageous.
It is indeed, and I really also like the comparison that you made, that you say as a former smoker, you don't want to be reminded of the tastes that you know that you had from cigarettes. So absolutely. Well, thank you, Michael, for joining us. You can find all the information about World Vapers Alliance on worldvapersalliance.com. And of course, do make sure to sign up and sign the petitions. Thank you, Michael, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me.
But now let's move to the main interview of the week with Benjamin Franke. We're talking about the EU's farm-to-fork strategy. So Benjamin, you are one of the policy experts in Brussels, I would say by far, on this specific topic of agriculture. You have a lot of opinions on it, and you've worked on it for quite a while. Of course, not all of our listeners are on top of their game when it comes to the agricultural reforms that the European Union is planning. We talked about farm to fork on this podcast before with my good friend Kerry Hardy. And so I wanted to get somebody who's really in the European Parliament, who sees the on the ground work to give his perspective. So explain to our listeners who hear about this for the first time, what is the pretended purpose of the farm to fork strategy? What does it want to achieve?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. Well, the Farm to Fork strategy is the Commission's first ever attempt to break out of silos of, farming policy, environmental policy, food policy, also consumer policy regarding food and nutrition. And I think it's a very needed approach to move out of the silo thinking and to try to connect the dots there and to get to a more holistic approach to the issue of the food chain.
Right, and in order to achieve that, the European Commission has a few target goals of reduction targets is what we see. That's sort of, you know, when you hear about farm to fork, when you read about it in the news, these reduction targets are really the main focus of what the Commission wants to reduce in terms of crop protection products and also fertilizers, and then it wants to get to more organic food production. Now, I've heard some in the European Parliament say that we don't know exactly what the effect of these policies will be, what the effect of these reduction targets are. Can you give us sort of a sense what is meant by these impact assessments? What does that mean? What are we trying to find out? What do some parliamentarians criticize towards the approach of the European Commission?
Yes, I fully agree that the reduction goals are very much at the center of the debate at the moment, or throughout the entire process, really, which is a shame because I think that we should be more forward-looking in general and more looking to how to enable innovation rather than to set goals for the reduction of inputs, as you said. So the Commission was very open about that. They set political targets. And they are not yet impact assessed. I mean, if they are become legally binding, there will have to be impact assessments. And yeah, we are currently working on a proper approach on how to look at this, because as you know, there are different targets and they will have a cumulative impact on the viability of the farming sector and on how farmers can do their business. So it would be very interesting to see indeed not just an impact assessment for every single target, but to look into how these targets work in a combined measure, in a combined sense.
Right, because the European Commission has not made an impact assessment yet, but the United States Department of Agriculture has completed one. And when they looked at it, it looked a bit grim for consumers. They found that it's fairly likely that consumer prices will go up and that also GDP could be affected by it. Do you have any view on this? Do you think that the targets, the political targets, as you also call them, that they could be influencing consumer prices in the long run, that consumers pay more for their products in the supermarket?
Well, I think in general, it's inevitable that consumers will pay more for products in the supermarket. It's very hard. Well, I'm not a scientist and I'm not crunching numbers on the targets myself. So it's very hard for me to comprehend what the effects will be. But I mean, it's obvious that if you have to reduce input as a farmer, on the one hand, you have to pay less for the input. On the other hand, it will affect your yields. It will affect the way you farm, which will need, for example, different approach on machinery, on digital tools, for example. So there comes a price tag to that. We are also talking about a huge share of organic farming, which we know is more expensive. So yes, I think it's very much necessary to better understand what happens on the field before we put something into legislation.
Yeah, and you mentioned this organic target. Now, currently in the European Union, we have about, 8%, 8-9% of organic purchases that are done, and we ought to get to a production of 25%. Now, of course, there's going to be quite some work to bridge that gap between the current consumption and the goals that the European Commission is trying to set. Maybe in from a political sense, how would you explain to our listeners the political push in the parliament towards more organic? From what perspective are those who say I've heard parliamentarians say we need to eventually get to 100% organic production, right? So what is sort of their background? What are they trying to achieve with those calls?
I think the problem is that in conventional farming, so to say, we see quite a lot of issues regarding sustainability. And sustainability, as you know, is a very complex idea, covering not just the climate, but also biodiversity, animal welfare, social aspects, but also economic aspects. And coming to the organic farming targets, I think that For a lot of people, organic farming equals sustainable farming, which is why they want to push for a higher share of organic farming. My personal opinion is that, well, looking back at how we got where we are as, mankind, progress has always been the way forward to solve like the big societal and global issues. And organic farming is not a very progressive, forward-looking way of farming. So my opinion is we should be a bit more open and broader in what we consider sustainable farming, not just organics or agro. There are different concepts out there. But would be better to maybe even, I mean, we could speak about setting a target, but we should make a target for sustainable farming, for areas under sustainable farming. And then we should come up with a system how to rate sustainability, which is possible.
Yeah, I think with all of these reduction targets in general, and it also works, you know, when we talk about mobility, is like either you reach the target naturally, in which case the target setting by the European Commission was not necessary, or you do not reach it, in which case you have to make some choices, which means that either you're going to sanction the member states, you're going to sanction the farmers, somebody will have to, you know, be pushed to achieve more. You mentioned earlier innovation. Recently, there was some quote unquote good news on the considerations that the European Union is making towards genetic engineering. How positive, and you know, we as the Consumer Choice Center, we're very positive on the innovation possible in the agricultural sector with genetic engineering. What did those recent declarations by the Commission mean? How much value do they have politically in order to make changes to directives that currently do not allow for us to use GMOs and gene editing in agriculture?
Well, eventually that depends on the will of the co-legislator, really, so the Parliament and the Council. Well, first of all, I think it's a good signal. It's a positive signal because the Commission commits itself to coming up with something positive. And I think that NGT, they are quite an important tool to reaching those targets, because if you want to use less input, if you want to increase yields or at least keep stable yields, you will need more resistant varieties of crops. And NGTs are our best bullet to get there.
So where exactly are we now in the political process of farm to fork? Because we had the presentation of the strategy, that is an intention of what we want to do. Then we will have presentations of plans. Those intend to explain to us how we will do them. And then eventually there will be legislation. Where exactly in the process are we, and what is the Parliament exactly doing right now on farm to fork?
Yes. So as you said, the Commission, they have presented their strategy with an annex including 28 or something concrete measures, which will be both in legislation and non-legislative. They are starting to roll out these one by one, so that there's not... I couldn't point my finger at where we are in this process, but we'll see the Commission coming up with concrete proposals one by one. In the next couple of years, really. I think the biggest thing the Commission has announced was a food policy framework, which is announced for the end of the mandate, so just before the elections in 2024 then. The Parliament currently is working on its report. You could say on its reply to the Commission strategy. So what we are doing is we are trying to come up with a preliminary Parliament position on each and every of the topics which have been included in the Commission's strategy.
And that's quite a lot of work. Can you speak to the divergence between member states on this? You know, for instance, when we talk about organic production, if you go to Austria is one of the leaders in terms of organic production. You work for an MEP from Germany, of course. And for us in Western and some of Central Europe, this is not as big of a conversation because agricultural reforms are constantly also in national news. But where are we when we talk about, you know, those member states in the east, when you talk about Romania and Bulgaria, where organic production is quite insignificant and agricultural reforms generally are also not politically that big of a topic? How can the institutions manage to get everyone on board and bridge the gap between different member states and their production levels and methods?
Yeah, that's a very complicated question, actually, because the farm to fork strategy is so comprehensive, as we said before, covering the agricultural production, covering the food food production chain, but also the consumers. So there is a huge variety of different issues where it's not easy to put several member states in a basket and say this is the one side of the opinion and this is the other side of the opinion. But of course, yes, you can, as in most debates and what we are doing, you do have some member states who are lagging behind when it comes to the use of antimicrobials in farming, when it comes to the share of organic farming. So it's very important to take into account with all the measures we're drawing up that we have different starting points and that member states are capable of different speeds to get to the targets. But I think there's a broad consensus that this needs to be taken into account.
Absolutely. So I have one more point I wanted to discuss with you before we get to the end of this segment. And this is something interesting, will be also interesting for you to hear, is that I was contacted by a few students who are currently researching Farm to Fork, and they have been tasked to write about Farm to Fork. This is in a communications journalism school, and they've been tasked with finding the people who are in favor and the people who are roughly against. Very easy journalistic assignment for students. And all of them are emailing me because I once wrote a piece for Your Active about Farm to Fork, in which I quite specifically say that I don't like most of the implications that Farm to Fork has to offer. Do you think that it is because of the way it's packaged, the way it's sold as a strategy, that it's really difficult to oppose it from the perspective of, you know, how quick it wants to achieve it and the effects of on consumers, that there's so much political pressure and it's so easy to say, well, you know, if you talk to a consumer, who doesn't like sustainability, right? But it's defined differently. It depends on who you ask, how you get there. Do you think it's, for some in the parliament, a bit complicated to be opposed to this strategy and criticizing it has to be packaged in some political mumbo jumbo in order to get to the actual point? Or would you say that members such as the one that you work for, Ulrike Müller, that there is a way of criticizing it without rejecting all the notions of achieving sustainability?
I would take a bit of a different approach here, because I think, as I said, and I think on the first question, it's very important to step out of the silos, because the task of making the entire food system more sustainable is so enormous that if you take the silo approach, you will not get there. This is quite clear. And you might not like things that are in the strategy, but as always, this is just like the Commission has only published one strategic document in which it outlines the strategy, which consists of many bits and pieces. And you will have the detailed discussions of the bits and pieces in the legislation that's coming. And we wouldn't want the Commission to be very precise, because most criticism is the Commission is not giving the answers on how to solve certain issues. They're putting targets out there and they cannot tell us how to achieve them. This is a fair point. But, well, we're at the beginning of the process, and first, the Commission couldn't give us the answers already now, and second, we wouldn't like it, because the co-legislators do want to have their say as well.
And that concludes this week's interview-heavy episode of Consumer. It's good to be back. Make sure to follow the MEP Ulrike Müller on Twitter, at Uli Müller MEP. You can also find that handle in the description of this episode. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only